This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're joined by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Chris Hedges to discuss the British vote to exit the European Union.
All hell is breaking loose. Let's talk with Chris Hedges about where real social change comes from.
As part of our Lawyers You'll Like segment, we're joined by civil liberties attorney Margaret Ratner Kunstler.
We sit down with her and learn why Margaret Ratner Kunstler is truly a lawyer you'll like.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Heidi, there was a major victory in the right for women to control their own bodies and have abortions when they need them that the Supreme Court decided last week. What was your reaction to it?
Well, Michael, I think everyone who looked at the front page of the newspaper last week who cares about women's reproductive health, the right to choose, was surprised so pleasantly that the Supreme Court found that what's called Texas Law HB 2 essentially poses too much of a burden on women seeking to exercise their constitutional right to have an abortion.
How do they impose the burden?
Well, first, they required clinics to have certain standards that they didn't apply to other procedures, for example, colonoscopy.
Other outpatient.
Exactly. Yeah. And so the result was that women would have to travel often hundreds of miles and have to wait 3 to 4 weeks to obtain an abortion. The result of that is that some early abortions were then put off so long it went into the second trimester.
The consequences of this sham or pretentious law were that it actually endangered women's health.
And it made it more difficult, especially for women with limited resources. They would have to pay for travel. We know they've been doing this, making it harder for women to obtain basic health services that they're entitled to, putting up barriers that make many either discouraged or unable to obtain those procedures. We should note this was a 5-3 decision, Michael, and that it affects over 5 million women of reproductive age in the state of Texas.
In the state of Texas alone.
It's
huge. This will be a domino effect.
Oh, yes.
These sham laws, which require the physicians to have admitting privileges at local hospitals and which require all these high-level surgical requirements at the clinics, those are going to fall. They've already fallen in Wisconsin, I think Alabama. The anti-abortion people are not going to be able to get away with this one. You can thank Justice Kennedy and Justice Breyer, who joined the three women justices on the Supreme Court against Alito and Thomas and Roberts. You can thank these five for preserving women's right to choose.
Michael, what do you think of the Victor Jara victory?
Tremendous victory for us at federal court in Florida. A Chilean soldier named Barrientos left Chile and came to live in Florida. He was one of Victor Jara's killers. Victor Jara was a great folk singer and social activist in Chile. He was picked up after the 9/11 1973 coup, the other 9/11, which was engineered by Henry Kissinger and other American corporate types. He was picked up and murdered. When his wife came a week later to reclaim his body, he had been shot 40 times. One of the soldiers who murdered him first crushed his hands and said, "You'll never play guitar again." Anyway, Barrientos, one of the killers, moved to Florida, was a short order cook in Florida for years, and he was identified, and he was tried under the Torture Victims Protection Act, found guilty, and the jury awarded a $28 million award to Victor Jara's wife, Joan. He leaves behind Joan and two daughters. Tremendous victory for us. Tremendous victory that these torturers, if they're found in the United States, can be tried and convicted. He's going to be sent back to Chile to face justice down there.
A rare victory indeed. domino effect has begun as banks and investment firms lose billions in the wake of Great Britain's decision to leave the European Union. The value of the British pound has dropped more than 9%, and global financial markets are in free fall. In a recent Truthdig article, 2008 All Over Again, by Chris Hedges, economist Michael Hudson blames the Brexit vote on Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. He says it was a response to the U.S. war policy in the Middle East and Ukraine that destroyed Libya and turned over weapons to Al-Qaeda. Those weapons ended up in their war in Syria. The mass exodus of refugees to Europe fueled nationalism and anti-immigrant sentiment. Meanwhile, countries such as France, Austria, and the Netherlands are positioning to do the same as the UK. Many suspect that banks will again turn to governments for bailouts, as they did in 2008. The question is, how will the American public respond to the effects of an increasing inequality, destruction of the environment, and trade deals that benefit the 1%? We're joined today by author and journalist Chris Hedges. He publishes weekly on Truthdig and has written 11 books. Chris, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Chris, all hell broke loose last week when a majority of the British citizens voted to exit from the European Union. Tell us what the European Union is, and then who initiated the referendum that resulted in the British vote to leave.
Well, there was pressure for a referendum, so Cameron gambled, thinking that he would put the issue to rest and win, and he lost. And I think that the referendum has been obscured as somehow a vindication of the right. It is certainly true that the right wing in Britain, as in much of Europe, is behind the disintegration of the European Union. But I think it's actually far more ominous than that. Because what has happened, and very, very similar to the United States, is that the surrender of essentially banking sovereignty to a European conglomerate run by an international banking system has had much the same effect that it's had in the United States, in that it has driven European wages down in the same way that wages have been stagnant or declined in the United States to be competitive, in the case of Europe, with, you know, Eastern European markets. In the case of the United States, you know, a global economy. And so for countries that are huge exporters like Germany, this has been, you know, advantageous. But for countries like France, Italy, and especially Greece, it's been a disaster because they can't print their own currency, in essence, to handle mounting deficits, so that there's a kind of constant contraction of the economy in the name of austerity that we've seen in Greece. And if you go, as I've been, to Birmingham and Manchester, these deindustrialized centers in Britain, they look like the remains of American deindustrialized centers, Detroit, Cleveland, and everywhere else. And so for working men and women, the EU, like all of neoliberal economics, has brought hardship and misery and spawned a kind of proto-fascism. Again, we see it with Trump. In the case of France and Greece, we in Poland now has essentially been taken over by a right-wing government. This is true in Croatia, other countries. So it's a very similar pattern, which is driven essentially by these neoliberal economic policies that have extracted tremendous costs from working men and women in Great Britain and certainly the United States and other countries.
What do you think that Jeremy Corbyn as the leader of the left in England. What do you think he should be standing for and talking about?
Well, you know, Corbyn supported staying in within the EU, although Corbyn was certainly very critical of the EU. We don't know yet how devastating this has been to financial firms, banks. They lost, of course, trillions of dollars. I think it's a pretty safe bet that some of these brokerage houses and financial firms now have negative equity. All of that we will watch it play out. It is going to have seismic ramifications within the European and the global economy. I think a lot of economists, Michael Hudson, who I spoke with, have raised the issue potentially down the road of calls for another bailout. British bank stock prices have dropped by 25%. Now, on the other hand, the Brexit vote, which I think may presage the unraveling of the Eurozone, also makes it very hard to push through trade agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It certainly weakens NATO. So, it is a kind of body blow, in many ways a kind of revolt. They kind of jokingly call it the revolt of the peasants in Britain, against these centralized forces that, have been kind of constructing forms of neo-feudalism globally.
Chris, in your recent article in Truthdig, 2008 All Over Again, you interviewed Michael Hudson, the economist. And he says that the vote is in response to this country's war policy in the Middle East and Ukraine. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I thought that was pretty smart, I like Michael. But he did make that point, and I think it's very valid, where he says that because a lot of this is driven by anti-immigrant sentiment. And now, since the Brexit vote, we've seen a series of very disturbing hate crimes in Britain. And so as people's standard of living have fallen outside of the financial centers like London in the same way that you have a financial center like Manhattan, so as people's standard of living has fallen, and these deindustrialized towns in the north of England are very depressing places in the same way that our deindustrialized cities are. There's just kind of nothing there. Schools are being closed. There's more of a kind of a safety net in Britain with the universal health care and stuff. But nevertheless, and that plays itself out or gives fodder to racists who claim that, things have deteriorated because we've let in, Pakistanis into Birmingham, or we've let in Syrian refugees, and the pressure that's been put on Europe, hundreds of thousands of people fleeing into Greece, into Europe, direct result of the disintegration in Iraq, in Syria, and Libya that we caused, created more pressure on Europe and exacerbated the nationalism and anti-immigrant sentiment. And Hudson says, and I think he's right, that and he also brings up the Ukraine, because we despite our promise to Gorbachev after the fall of the Berlin Wall that NATO would not expand beyond Germany, our arms industry wanted new markets, which they now have, and that's part of the problem too. So countries like Poland are spending all these monies on weapons, when they should be attempting to deal with the dislocations within their own economy. So that has put a lot of pressure on Europe, and it is a direct result of the failed war policies of the Bush and Obama administrations, yes.
Speaking of the Obama administration. Let me ask you about his former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, who looks like she's in line to become president. Clinton, as we know, was very close to Goldman Sachs, made all those speeches and got all that money from them. We're not sure what she talked about with them. We can only guess. It might have been about, my guess is, Goldman Sachs's role in managing the American economy. But nevertheless, if this Brexit has ramifications here in the United States, and I think it certainly will, and there are banks in the United States that are in trouble and need a bailout, and Clinton helps out on that, what do you think the ramifications of that are here in this country?
I think that would be extreme. I don't think that the American public is going to stomach a bailout to the tune of what we saw in 2008. Yet, there's no question that the Democratic Party and Barack Obama would bail them out if these financial firms came to them in the kind of distress that financial firms like Lehman Brothers underwent in 2008. And at that point, it's going to be very hard for Obama, Clinton, and the Democrats to talk it with any kind of credibility. I think they're already very suspect, but talk with any credibility about serious financial reform or curbing the kind of wholesale looting of the U.S. Treasury that has characterized Wall Street and large banks, Citibank, Wells Fargo, big banks since 2008. So that could be extremely damaging. We don't know the extent. We know it's bad. We don't know how bad. You know, it will take a little while for all of this to sort out. But it's clear that there's been some very serious damage done to this form of casino capitalism, because a lot of it's just betting. You know, they're betting that people will stay in the euro or they'll leave the euro or... So I think if that happened, you know, I don't discount a Trump presidency, unfortunately, anyway, but I think if that happened, the anger could be such that it could propel Trump into the White House. You know, part of the problem is that, of course, Hillary Clinton, unlike Bernie Sanders, epitomizes everything both sides of the political spectrum in this primary campaign rose up against.
Yeah, I'm reminded of that famous story that Ron Suskin, the journalist and author, told about Obama in 2008 meeting with the leading bankers in the United States. And the bankers were plenty nervous because they knew that Obama was popular and could really do what he wanted to do. And Obama came into the room and he quieted him down. And he said, "Don't worry." He said, "I'm the only thing that stands between you and the pitchforks, and I'm not here to hurt you."
Right.
And I think that...
Well, he's proven that to be true.
Yeah, that's for sure. But I'm not sure they could get away with it again.
No, I think the second time around, I think people have kind of seen through that game. Yeah, I mean, this could have very dire, not only economic, but political consequences.
So what are you advising people when they say, "Chris Hedges, where do you stand on this election? We know you don't want Trump, and we know you don't like Hillary Clinton, but Trump is worse, and therefore we have to hold our nose and vote for Clinton." It seems to me
that... Well, but that's getting caught up in the whole battle of personalities that now defines the American election cycle. And in fact, the system itself will function quite well whether it's under Trump or Clinton or Bush or Obama. This system that Sheldon Wolin calls inverted totalitarianism, where essentially corporations have seized not only, of course, the systems of information along with the systems of entertainment, but the three branches of government. I mean, there really is no way to vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs. It doesn't matter who's president.
True.
And I worry that people are very short-sighted in believing that somehow electing Hillary Clinton is going to make things better. Trump is the result of the embrace of neoliberal policies by especially the Clinton administration, but the Democratic Party, the selling out of working men and women, and the reaction, the anger that we saw feeding both the two insurgencies, means that Trump is not the phenomena. He's reacting to the phenomena. So allowing these policies to continue means that you may physically get rid of Trump, but you're going to cough up or vomit up something as vile and perhaps more dangerous and less idiotic. And so I'm a great believer in third parties. I've, you know, worked as Nader's speechwriter. I will support the Green Party. I think we have to look at countries like Spain, Podemos. They didn't do as well in the elections as they thought they would, but they didn't do badly. Syriza, 10 years ago, was polling at 4%. And I think we have to seriously begin to build alternative movements and alternative political parties, because if not, we're ceding everything to the proto-fascists. If we, I speak as a member of, you know, the left, I suppose, refuse to stand up for working men and women, and that is really what you do by capitulating to the Democratic Party establishment, then you are ultimately down the road feeding a very, very dangerous force, which is already expressing itself in right-wing, white, nativism, neo-confederacy, the Christian right. We have to look beyond a particular election cycle. We keep getting caught up in the election cycle. And I think that movements throughout history have demonstrated, effective movements, that they often have to walk into the political wilderness for perhaps as long as a decade. And we have to take that chance. We haven't even spoken about climate change, because the neoliberal elites are going to drive us quite literally over an ecological and a financial cliff. And the manifestations of it, the symptoms of morbidity, as Antonio Gramsci would say, are going to be really unpleasant. And so it's time for us to kind of grow up and stop getting caught up in this infantile debate of Donald and Hillary, or, you know, that and begin to understand systems of power. If we don't understand systems of power, we can't fight it. And, of course, you know, all despotic forms of power work overtime to make sure they mask their true reality.
Chris Hedges, I can't think of a better point to end on. And as it happens, we're running out of time. Heidi and I are very grateful for your being on Law and Disorder.
I'll be in the streets in Cleveland and Philadelphia. I'll be in Philly.
Great.
I'm marching without a permit.
We'll see you there.
We'll be joining you there, Chris. You
good.
Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks. You. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
For our Lawyers You'll Like series, we're joined today by civil rights attorney Margaret Kunstler. Throughout her career, she has provided support and protected the rights of activists. She's been a consultant to the Occupy Wall Street and Anonymous protesters. Her book, Hell No, Your Right to Dissent in 21st Century America, was co-authored with Michael Ratner and remains a leading handbook for activists. Margaret has advised WikiLeaks, Bradley Manning supporters, and others in connection with grand jury subpoenas. Together with her late husband William Kunstler, the subject of the documentary Disturbing the Universe, Margaret worked on high-profile cases, including the Virgin Island Five, Attica, and Wounded Knee. She is founder of the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice that works to combat racism in the criminal justice system. Margaret was also a founding member of the National Lawyers Guild's New York City Chapter's Mass Defense Committee that continues to provide legal observers at mass demonstrations and to represent those arrested.
Attorney Margaret Ratner Kunstler, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
It's so good to have you on the program, Margaret. You were born right after World War II, and you were the daughter of political parents. You were what we used to call a red diaper baby. So I wanted to ask you, what's a red diaper baby, and what kind of advantage did that give you in terms of being a politically conscious person?
Well, I think there are many different types of red diaper babies. I don't think we're all of a class. I was a red diaper baby with parents who were scared and very scared of everything. One morning I woke up and the entire library seemed to have disappeared. I think that they were afraid of being subpoenaed or something else, but they were very nervous and they didn't want me to participate in any political activity. They were too nervous, and I was taught to keep secrets. Everything was secret. I don't even know what the secrets were, but I couldn't reveal anything. Everything was secret.
And that's because they had been active in the Communist Party, and the Red Scare, the witch hunt, was going on.
That's correct. But I imagine, and I do know, that there were people who responded much more bravely to the Red Scare than my parents did, and they just were not capable of that kind of strength.
And how did you respond to your parents' fears in terms of how it molded or didn't your own radicalism?
Well, it certainly had an effect on me. It made me very much of an introvert because I was always afraid to say anything. And when I wanted finally to go on demonstrations while I was in high school, it was a battle. And I would say, Mommy, everybody is on the bus. Why can't I be on the bus? And a couple of times they would let me be on the bus with everybody else, but they were still, even at that point, very nervous.
Were you involved after those early possible bus experiences with the civil rights movement?
Well, when I was in college, I was away, so I was much freer. And then I did take buses on every bus that was available. And I did voter registration in Bronxville. And I also led a march in favor of the hospital workers in Bronxville. So I was quite active and known as a peculiarly political person.
So why did you go to law school, or didn't you go to law school initially?
I did go to law school initially. I went to the Institute of Fine Arts, which is part of NYU, and I was going to study art history. And at the end of my first year, I decided not to continue. I mean, I had a great fellowship, so everybody was saying, stick it out, and it can't be that bad. But there were a couple of things about it that really upset me. One was, every Friday they had a tea. Now, having a tea is okay, but one of the female students had to pour. And I refused to pour tea. I never went to a tea, and I refused to pour tea. And then the rest of the students were very kind of stiff. They wouldn't share any of their ideas because they were writing it up in some way. So that made me feel funny. And then I realized that I was going to have to do this for very many years until I could get a job. And I didn't have the energy to go through it for that many years. So I then applied to law school.
So you went to Columbia Law School. That was the scene of one of the great student strikes of the 60s. Why did the students go on strike? What was Columbia doing that you didn't like? And what was it like?
Well, Columbia was very active in supporting the war. Many of its departments were working out intelligence services for the war. And at the same time, they were going to build a gym in Morningside Park, which is one of the few public parks in Harlem. Both of those things coalesced. I mean, there were a lot of people who were anti-war, and we were all frustrated about the war. We couldn't get anywhere with stopping it, and there were mass demonstrations all the time.
We're talking 1968, after a couple of huge, half a million people demonstrations.
Right, and there was no response to it. In fact, I think that there was escalation, as far as I can remember. Given those two things, and at Columbia there was a lot of research being done on the Columbia's participation in the war, and a lot of research on Columbia's racism. So those two things got together, and I met a lot of wonderful people. We got very active in what was happening on the campus. The law school was not, obviously, as active as the college, as the university, but it was active, and a number of the law school students did occupy buildings, but most of us didn't. We just kind of stood out in front of the buildings and picketed and did other things.
Was that when you first became involved with the National Lawyers Guild?
Yes. 700 people were arrested on April 14th. And it was at that time that we figured out we had to have a response to this and figure out how to represent all the people who were arrested. So Columbia's National Lawyers Guild chapter reformed. And it hadn't been active since the 50s because of the Red Scare, and everybody was afraid to join the National Lawyers Guild and be called a communist. So we reformed the chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, and we took different roles in terms of what was happening that year. We brought a lawsuit against the university, which outlined all of the issues that the students were trying to bring. And a number of us worked in the guild office under Mary Kaufman, which was the Mass Defense Office, getting lawyers to represent the 700 people who had been arrested. And that's how I spent my entire summer, was in the guild office finding lawyers and going to court occasionally.
Thus was the beginning of the Mass Defense Committee, which
yes.
continues to do amazing work, and which you're still involved in.
So amazingly, you graduated. And did you go out and hang up a shingle or get a legal defense job? What did you do next?
My first job was with the Criminal Division of Legal Aid. And I seem to have made a few problems for the administration there because I was sent, I was in Manhattan at 100 Center Street. And I don't quite remember what I said that was objectionable, but I did say something. And I was sent to Brooklyn at the same time Bruce Wright was being punished and sent to Brooklyn. So we were both exiled to Brooklyn together. And I had a wonderful time, and I think he had a good time too. At that point, one of the major misdemeanors that we came through the court was possession of stolen vehicles. And I tried every one of those cases, and Bruce acquitted everyone for that case. Because
Bruce Wright was the great African-American judge.
The defense was always, I bought it at the barbershop. Now, most people don't know how central a barbershop is to the black community, or at least was at that time. And in fact, business deals were conducted at the barbershop. So Bruce, of course, understood that that's what happened, and so there was always reasonable doubt.
Then didn't you do some private practice first before you went to the Center for Constitutional Rights?
Yes. I did some private practice with Michael Ratner. We were on a wonderful floor in 351 Broadway. I don't know if that building exists anymore. I hear it
does.
It does.
Yeah.
Yes.
And we did a lot of very interesting work. And then I took a job with the Grand Jury Project. And I was the director of the Grand Jury Project for a couple
of
years.
Let's talk about that, because
it was a guild project.
It was a guild project.
Yeah, and the grand juries were not good, and you fought them. And tell us what was going on.
Well, one of the major things that the Grand Jury Project did, which was why we were so effective, was we did a book called How to Represent Witnesses Before Federal Grand Juries. And all over the country, there were federal grand juries subpoenaing people who they believed were political activists. And that was enough, really, to subpoena people to grand juries. And
you had to talk or risk being jailed.
Yes, you were subpoenaed to the grand jury, and you would refuse to testify if you were with us. And then you would be given immunity. Now, immunity means that you cannot refuse to testify. The immunity is a terrible immunity. In just 1966, they limited the immunity law, so that it wasn't transactional immunity. It was only immunity over the things that you specifically testified to at that time. Immunity wouldn't have helped anyway, so it didn't really matter. But you were subpoenaed to the grand jury, and if you refused to testify, then there was a procedure for the U.S. attorney to go to Washington, go to the Justice Department, and get an immunity order. And the immunity order went to the judge, and then if you still refused to testify, then you had a contempt hearing. And many, many people spent many months in jail. The maximum at that time was 18 months, because that was the life of the grand jury. Subsequent to that, more recently, people have spent even more time in grand juries, and I even had a couple of cases where the contempt was the second contempt of an individual before a grand jury, and the prosecutor went for criminal contempt. Mm-hmm. So the sentence there was significantly longer.
And there came a time that you began working at the Center for Constitutional Rights, which was a small, scrappy outfit in those days. And what were you doing there?
Well, at first I was very much involved in the Central America work, but I was also involved in advising people all over the country who would call into the center to ask, what should I do? An FBI agent came to visit. And that worked out. It was not only visits, it was travel to Cuba, it was travel to Nicaragua, it was sending medicine to Cuba. There were many, many issues that people kept calling about. And at that time, there were really black bag jobs where the FBI broke into various offices.
Including mine.
And that was the beginning of the center's mass defense office. So I kind of went back to mass defense at that point.
Was that when you wrote the book, If an Agent Knocks?
Yes. Oh, but that was a pamphlet. It wasn't quite a book, but it said, you know, it went through your rights if you were approached by an agent on the street, if the agent knocked at the door, what your response could be and what you could legally get away with. And it said, you know, call me right away if it happens.
Speaking of mass defense, you were very active here in New York during the 2004 RNC, the Republican Convention, which saw a huge number of people preemptively arrested. You had the Writ Squad. Can you talk about that?
Well, we had suspected that there was going to be a lot of demonstrations around the RNC. So really, the Guild got together 6 months before and formed different squads to deal with the arrests and everything else that was going to happen, getting permits. There was a permit squad, there was a writ squad, there was a squad that got lawyers for people to get people out of jail. The writ squad was formed in case people were held for over 24 hours. And that, in fact, happened, and the writ squad did a writ of habeas corpus, and in fact was successful, and actually got damages that we contributed to the Guild.
Because the people were detained in that pier with horrible condition, I guess, chemicals on the floor. Right. And then wasn't the other side penalized for refusing to, I think something happened, and the judge really made an example of the prosecutors in that, I thought. Anyway, it was very dramatic.
It was very dramatic.
And the Guild did an amazing job.
The Guild did a great job. And it was all the planning that went on ahead of time, really, that made it possible.
Attorney Margaret Ratner Kunstler, in the course of all this activity, you managed to raise two wonderfully accomplished daughters, Sarah Kunstler and Emily Kunstler. And I'm sure that our listeners are wondering, how does one do all that at the same time? What were the challenges of raising a family at the same time you were practicing movement law?
Well, at first it was easier because there were so many people involved in the movement that there were people volunteering to help in any way possible. So when I would go to federal court with Sarah, because I was breastfeeding, there would always be someone who would take Sarah into the court. So at that point, it was much easier. Then it became more difficult because the movement wasn't as strong, and there weren't as many people involved and engaged in helping people to carry out their activities. And then when, fortunately for me, my mother came around when they were about 8 years old. My father had died, and my mother was available. So that really freed me up because, you know, if you have your mother taking care of your children, you really don't have to worry. And, you know, I called her my great emancipator.
What was it like practicing with Bill Kunstler? We should back up. You were married to Bill. Bill was an extraordinary civil rights lawyer. He'd been Martin Luther King's lawyer at one point, and you two did some work together. Talk to us about that.
Well, I was working at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and Bill was on. He wasn't on staff. He was a He was an officer, I believe, and he had an office there too. And he was always looking for somebody to second chair him in cases. And I really wanted to be a criminal defense attorney, so I jumped at every opportunity. The first case I did with him was not a criminal case. It was a civil case for expungement of a record where a large group of people had gone to a political meeting and the police had busted it up and arrested everybody for no reason at all. So we expunged their records, and that was the first trial I had with him. The second trial I did with him was in the South. It was in Norfolk, Virginia. And there was, every year they have an azalea festival in Norfolk, Virginia, and our client had been accused of throwing a rock at the Azalea Queen.
Throwing a rock at the Azalea Queen.
When Bill cross-examined the cop, he said, well, which hand did he throw the rock in? And the cop said, the right hand. Now, we've all heard this story before, but it's so rare that it would work. Then when the client took the stand, he said, now, I'm going to ask you, are you right-handed or are you left-handed? And he threw a ball to the client, and so he was acquitted.
And did you get involved in the Attica cases?
I did the first omnibus discovery motion, and then a couple of years later, I was one of the lawyers on indictment number one, which was the only conviction in the Attica cases.
And then, staying relevant with the times, you were very active in supporting anonymous related individuals, Jeremy Hammond.
I was following Anonymous, and I was really terribly impressed by the organizing work and the work they were doing. So I put the word out. Anybody comes across an Anonymous case that winds up in New York City, please let me know.
Tell who Anonymous is.
Anonymous is a loose, very loose association of hackers who do various hacking activities or internet activities to support various political causes that they agree with.
So you put the word out. What happened?
Well, then I got a call. I think it was from Chicago, from a lawyer in Chicago, saying, client I represented last year on an assault charge. He had been arrested for a battle with some neo-Nazis. Is being transferred to New York on a federal charge on related to hacking. I said, "Oh, I've got to have this case." But the problem was that I needed to have some kind of institutional support. So I called up Liz Fink and I said, "Listen, we'll go in and we'll say that he'll say he wants us, and you'll say you're willing to do it, and you're on the CJA panel, and we'll get the case." So we did that, and we got the case.
That's the panel that the federal judges choose people from, and then they get compensated. So it's
right.
It's difficult to get on that panel, but it's an important accomplishment to be on it.
Right, because you don't have any it's not only the pay for the lawyers, it's the pay for investigators and for other things that are in transcripts and all the things you really need to represent a client properly.
What are you involved in now?
Right now I'm representing Sarah Harrison. And the background of that is when, I don't know if people remember it, but as soon as Sarah accompanied Snowden to Hong Kong, she released a statement that I thought was so brave and so bold, asserting why she had done what she did, and absolutely made me so proud of her activity. And it was one of those things that I sent to my daughters, you know. It was one of the few things. I think the thing I sent to them earlier was Anita Hill. These tremendously heroic women who stand up and do very scary things. So I let Sarah know. I wrote to her and I said, that statement was so beautiful and I loved it. And if you ever need help, I'm available. What happened is that she hasn't been indicted in the U.S., but the problem is that there is a grand jury investigation of both Julian Assange, and Snowden is already indicted. And it is our feeling that she would not be tried separately, but if either of these people went to trial, that she would be in the situation of being a co-conspirator or an aider and abettor. So she really needs the kind of protection of people looking out for her. And one of the things I did do for her is I investigated and got her a lawyer in London, who she likes very much. But she's not in London. She's British, but she is with a community of expats in Berlin because it's safer to be in Berlin than it is to be in London.
Margaret, politically, I know that you strongly believe in the rule of law and in democracy. And my question to you is, do you believe that democracy and the rule of law are compatible with capitalism?
No, absolutely not compatible. As long as the means of production are not in the hands of the people who do the work, then there'll be injustice and inequality in this world.
Do you have any parting words of advice or inspiration for young attorneys or law students who are interested in pursuing the kind of work you do but might be a little nervous about what it's like?
Well, they have a right to be nervous about what it's like. But I do think that it's important to take a risk. And if you find any place in the country that something is happening and you are a lawyer, don't be afraid to go to a different jurisdiction and volunteer and get involved in what's happening. It's critically important. It used to be years and years ago we would travel easily. We would go to Wounded Knee. But now people aren't traveling as much. But I recommend that we bring back the itinerant lawyer and get to work.
Margaret, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.